Hi, this is Georgia Mancho of the Revoice Festival, and I'm chatting to Jan Ilunga at the Jazz Spotlight.
Episode 68.
Welcome to the Jazz Spotlight, the podcast that gives you the insight and tools you need to be in the music industry today. Artists, authors, and top music industry experts give you actionable tips that will help you promote yourself the smart way. Here's your host, Jan Ilunga.
Hey everybody, what's up? Jan Ilunga here with the Jazz Spotlight podcast with the 68th episode. I hope you're having a great day and you're ready for the weekend. But first of all, I hope you're ready for another great episode because you're gonna love this one today. Really, trust me on that. If you've been with me before, you know that sometimes we have episodes like Tuesday's episode that are a bit more technical, where we talk about skills, about tools, about tactics, and we learn new skills, we learn about new tools, and we learn actionable tips. And sometimes we have inspiring episodes, such as today's. Today we talk about how to organize a music festival as a do-it-yourself musician. So if you are out there, you have ever dreamed of organizing your own music festival, whether if it's just a 2-day festival, a 1-week festival, 1 month, whatever you have dreamed of, you're going to learn more about that today. Because my guest, she's going to tell her story, how she became a jazz singer and how she established her own music festival in London. And my guest today is jazz singer Georgia Mancho. Like always, guys, you find the links with everything Georgia and I talk about in the show notes at thejazzspotlight.com/episode68. Here is how to organize a festival as a do-it-yourself musician with Georgia Mancho. Have fun. Hey everyone, I'm here for another fun and great episode of the Jazz Spotlight podcast with a very, very special guest and friend of the Jazz Spotlight. And today we talk about how to organize a music festival. And it's a very exciting topic. I know that some of you have been maybe thinking about starting their own music festival, be it a 2-day festival, 3 days, 1 week festival. And we're going to hear more about the founder of Revoice Festival, Georgia Mancho. We're not only going to talk about festival, but we're also going to talk about, you know, Georgia's career. She's going to tell us more about Revoice, how it started, what to think about when we want to start music festival, and much, much more. It's with great pleasure that I welcome her on the show. Hey, Georgia, how is your day going?
Hi, yeah, nice to speak to you.
You too. I know that you're in London, and I have to ask you, how is your winter? How has the winter been so far in London?
Yeah, it's not possible to talk to a British person without asking about the weather.
I know. Right.
It's very nice sunny day today, and the snow, which happened for about 2 hours yesterday, has gone. So, but it's cold. It's very, very cold. So it's going to be a long winter, I think, unfortunately.
Well, but look at the bright side. At least now there is the Jazz Spotlight that brings some fun, some energy. So after this, you're going to have a great week, I'm sure.
Great. So I'm looking forward to it.
All right. I mentioned the Revoice Festival, and we're going to talk about that more later on. But first of all, can you tell the listeners a little bit more about you and your career? Who is Georgia Mancho?
I'm a jazz singer. That's my first job, and hopefully my last job, because I did a few before. And I'm also a lyricist. I've been doing quite a lot of writing in the last few years. I'm coming into my 15th year as a professional musician. And I kind of fell into music slightly by accident. It was something I always wanted to do. My grandparents, who were both Italian, were professional classical musicians. But because I was brought up in the UK, I didn't really have that direct link, I guess, to sort of seeing what how it, maybe it was possible to be a professional musician. So it wasn't really on my radar in the same way if I'd come from, you know, sort of maybe my parents had been musicians. So I didn't really have the kind of knowledge or the confidence to kind of think about music as a career. And I did quite a lot of acting and then decided that I wanted to go into filmmaking. And so I was studying filmmaking. And while I was studying filmmaking, I had a part-time job at Ronnie Scott's Jazz Club, just waitressing. And it was perfect because I loved the music. I used to go, but because I was a student, I couldn't go that much. And so I thought this is a really nice way to balance everything out. And then ironically, from working there and meeting musicians, and it kind of just demystified the idea of being a working musician, because obviously you saw the big name stars, but you also, you know, saw the local musicians on the scene. And I realized pretty quickly that sort of makes the heart of any scene, is the people you're going to come into contact with regularly, you know, and they're the sort of heartbeat of any scene. And I just found straight away that they were very inclusive and not snobby. If, you know, if you sort of expressed an interest in maybe wanting to sing and wanting to do some gigs, I didn't get the sense that there was a sort of us and them, you know, oh, you're not a professional. So I was lucky because I had a couple of people who really encouraged me and helped me to get a couple of gigs. And, you know, ironically, I was going to say ironically, because it was easier to start getting gigs as a, you know, a very inexperienced singer than it was to sort of make a kind of break into the film industry, which I found more sort of complicated and sort of labyrinthine to find a route in. So eventually one just sort of overtook the other, because I realized that neither industry is something you can do half-heartedly. I think, you know, you kind of have to throw yourself into something. So I just started, and without any idea of a plan or where it would lead to, just to see if I could make a living, which I think is a huge thing when you're starting out, whether you've come out of college or, you know, you start in a maybe more unconventional way like me. I think that's the main thing. And when I eventually got to that stage, you know, then you just try to keep going. and that's kind of the achievement, really, is, you know, becomes harder and harder in a way, because music is so overpopulated. You know, there's so many fantastic musicians, especially now coming out of colleges. So if you can just keep going and going and going, making a living and broadening your experience and improving all the time, then, you know, that's a pretty a good achievement. So I've just really gone from there and learning on the way, and working with some fantastic people and picking up some great experiences.
Love it. Love your story. And guys, maybe you remember on episode 65, where we talked about artist management with Sandra Marcy. Sandra had nothing but great words for Georgia. She actually talked about Georgia and how she's an incredible, talented musician who does it all. So she's a musician, she's a singer, she's a lyricist, she's a festival organizer. And as we've just heard from Georgia, she started in a kind of unconventional way, but I think it also should be an inspiration for those of you who are listening, who are dreaming about becoming professional artists. You know that you can really do it. And Georgia has told us as how she started out kind of as a student, you know, not really, she didn't kind of wake up when she was six and she became a star. She built her career, her passion as well, like day after day, and now she's where she is. And I remember that I read on your website, georgiamancio.com, I was reading about your biography, and I saw that in 2005, you won the first prize at the Brussels International Young Jazz Singers Competition. So first of all, congrats for the achievement.
Thank you.
You're so welcome. And I wanted to ask you, for first of all, what you remember about that experience, and if you have any tips for those listeners who are maybe about to participate in such competition.
Yes, I remember it very, very well, because actually it had a big impact on me. I'd never done anything like that. And a friend who lived in Brussels had seen an advert for it and suggested that I give it a go. And I really thought twice about it because I was very nervous about the idea of being in a competition, and it seemed quite alien to me, but I thought I should be brave and try. And it was a fascinating experience, actually, because I think, you know, although I'm very much a singer who listens to other singers and other musicians, I think it's a different setup where you have how they worked is, you know, people would send in a CD and then they would select semi-finalists, and I think there were 16 semi-finalists who they invited to Brussels to then perform live a small set with a house trio. So what you had, and it was over 4 days, and I think I was there for the last three or something. But you know, you end up with this experience where you're seeing singer after singer after singer doing a very short, you know, set, and it really was fascinating because you don't really have that setup normally where you see so much of your same instrument, but you know, very very different one after the other. And what I realized quickly is that you get this sort of, you're like a sponge, because you immediately, you hear things you like from one person, you hear something that maybe you don't like from another, something you wish you could do, something you know, you feel happy that you've also achieved, you know, and it, so you kind of get this, well, for me, it was like an instant sort of shot of education from each of these singers who are all very, very different. But you also realize when you come then to do your set, you know, with nerves and, you know, and being watched by other singers, and the fact that it's a competition and you're in a town that isn't your own, and, you know, in a country that isn't your own, all of this going on, you have to find yourself. You have to be true to your voice wherever you're at that stage, you know, because we all have, you know, ideas of who we would like to be and like to sound like, and we're all working to improve all of the time. And I'm sure there isn't a musician in the world who wouldn't say, you know, that they're always improving and always hoping to improve, and therefore always slightly dissatisfied with where they're at. It's sort of, you know, hand in hand, I think. But that sort of intensity makes you realize, well, you know, maybe I've now got a slight lick that I heard someone do last night, or intonation of someone that I really liked. And you might find it creeps into your work, but really, you would end up as a sort of pastiche if you you know, have that line from that person. So you have to just go, okay, this is what I can do. It's not as good as some people, it's better than others, but this is where I'm at now, and, you know, and be honest about that. And so I don't think I'd thought about that so much beforehand, although, you know, I think I found my style quite early on. But, you know, I think that sort of under the spotlight, when you're forced to, you know, just have only maybe 15 minutes to present what you do, you have to hit the ground running. And it was a really, really good experience, you know, for all other sort of, you know, stressful situations, you know, in years afterwards. And actually, when we talk about Revoice, I'll tell you how it sort of influenced a lot to do with the way I set up Revoice. So I think that's the advice, really, is to try and just to be yourself, you know, and remember that you're just doing what you can do for that 15 minutes or however long it is. And, you know, it's going to be such a subjective thing, because who you might think is better than you might, you know, not make it to the finalist round, you know, because the judges have decided that they prefer you. You know, it's such a personal thing. I think, you know, I was very surprised and obviously delighted to win, but it just shows, you know, I didn't think I was the best singer. So, you know, but there's obviously more to it. There's, you know, there's how you present the music and the emotion and everything that goes with it. You know, maybe you're listening to other singers in a different way to how someone's listening to you. It's quite fascinating.
Yeah, no, it sounds from your recollection of that experience, sounds very fascinating. For sure, stressful. I can't imagine. Yeah. I really can't, but for sure it's also like fun thinking about it, you know, how maybe you have evolved compared to those times, how your stage presence or, you know, maybe even the style has changed a little bit. It's interesting. Yeah. And you said that you listen to other musicians, and I have to ask you, you know, do you have a couple of artists that you would recommend to all the jazz singers or those that would like to be jazz singers who are listening to you and I right now? Do you have a couple of either singers, vocalists you want to recommend, or a couple of albums that you really, you know, that you really love and want to share?
Yeah, sure. I guess, you know, I think that the things that you hear early on really stay with you, because, you know, you make it probably a more emotional connection than maybe later as you learn more about your craft. I think you become more critical in a good and bad sense, but when you're listening, you know, with more experience yourself, you're listening for different things, I think. So the first things I ever heard had a real emotional impact on me, and if I just liked somebody's sound, I, you know, it was because it was a direct emotional pull. Maybe I wasn't thinking about their technique. And so the first singers that really kind of, you know, made me sit up and think, wow, you know, this is wonderful. Anita O'Day was a big one for me, because there was just something so fresh about her approach. And, you know, it's very skillful, but it's so playful, I think, that, you know, you almost don't realize how good it is until you try and copy it. Especially, I don't know, T for Two at 300 beats a minute, or, you know. So she definitely had a big influence on me. Norma Winston definitely had a big influence on me, completely different stylistically, but because she's British, I think, you know, that helped me to think, you don't have to sing with an American accent, for instance. And, you know, it was a more direct link to what I was doing. And Nancy Wilson, also somebody I listened to very early on, who I was just so struck by the color in her voice. There's so much nuance, and, you know, the way even on one word she would, you know, give you so much light and shade, or, you know, drama and emotion. And obviously it's a flawless instrument as well, which helps. But, you know, I realized that it's not just about the instrument, it's about the, you know, everything that goes with it, the performance that goes with it. Another person that I listened a lot to, and actually stopped listening to because I was worried that I would almost try and copy her because I loved her voice so much, was Irene Krall. Who I find that her singing is so emotional. It's so understated, but it's so emotional that it's actually quite hard to listen to her if you don't want to feel sad. You know you're going to go there and be moved by it. But that's quite an amazing thing, I think, to be that moved by somebody. You know, so her albums with Alan Broadbent and we can talk about that a bit more later, but there were two duo albums that they made in the early 70s that really struck a chord, Where Is Love and The Gentle Rain. And a musician recommended them to me. And there was just something so pure about the balance between just the duo, for starters. You know, it's such a pure direct contact. The balance between this soulful sound and, you know, very straight singing, it's just so clear and clean, and the ideas are so well executed, and this beautiful piano playing, you know, that had these gorgeous flourishes and great feel of Alan Broadbent, and never interrupted the flow. In fact, you know, always added to the flow. And those two albums really, really struck a chord with me. Definitely. So lots of people, and Carmen McRae, I would say, is probably the other one who, it's just this, again, the storytelling in her delivery is just phenomenal. You know, listening to your podcast with Dee Dee Bridgewater, and she was talking about acting lessons and how she would encourage singers to do acting lessons. And I've always kind of been fascinated by that because I did a lot of acting before I started singing. But when I came to singing, I found it almost got in the way in that I didn't want to sort of act. I don't like the thought of acting through the music because I want to feel it. And it's probably taken me, you know, until this year, I would say, to, you know, last year to sort of understand how, you know, you do have to act a bit as well, because not everything you sing about is going to be your experience. But it's good if you've had that experience. I think it makes a difference. But, you know, it's finding that balance where you feel that you're being truthful, but you're still performing the music, you know, and you don't feel you're being over the top, overstating something, you know, just to get that balance right.
Okay, guys, there you go. Personal recommendations of some singers and musicians you should listen to, who Georgia Mancho recommends. And guys, in case you missed some names, or, you know, you forgot to take notes, no problem. Like every episode, you find the links to everything Georgia and I talk about, the artists she just mentioned, everything and everyone is included in the show notes, so no worries. Okay, Georgia, you mentioned Revoice when you talked about the Brussels International Young Jazz Singers Competition. You mentioned Revoice, and Revoice is your international festival that usually takes place in autumn, in fall, in October. Last edition was in October, in several jazz venues around London. Can you tell the listeners how you came up with the idea of Revoice Festival? Because, you know, you really kind of went from dreaming about a festival to actually coming up with the idea to actually put it in place for a few years in a row. So can you tell the listeners kind of how the, you know, how Revoice got started and how you took it from kind of a dream to an actual event?
I mean, if I'm totally honest, I didn't think this is going to be an international voice festival when I started, and I didn't have a sort of vision of where it was going, which, you know, is interesting, because I wonder if it would have been a very different, you know, animal if I had. but really, the idea was just to do some kind of residency, some kind of series, I guess. And actually, at the very beginning, it wasn't even going to be exclusively vocal, because there was a band of great American drummer, Eric Harland, that I had seen. Mm-hmm. And he actually is a really good singer as well. So maybe that was partly in the back of my mind. And I thought, this is such a great band. They never have played in London, and they should come to London. And so it was kind of one of the things I'd thought of. And then there were a couple of vocalists that I thought hadn't been in London for far too long, or some of them hadn't played in London at all. And I really wanted to see them here. So I thought, well, instead of waiting for somebody else to bring them here, maybe I could just do something, you know, sort of without thinking too deeply about it. So I had a meeting with the Pizza Express Jazz Club, which, if your listeners don't know, is a fantastic venue in Soho in London that's been running for many, many, many years, and has live music 7 nights a week. And I think they even have weekend lunchtime gigs now. So it's a really important venue in our scene, and in the European jazz scene. And the music manager there, Ross Dines, is great, because he's so open to hearing from musicians. You know, he's approachable and he's open-minded. And I'd played there quite a few times with my band. So obviously we had a working relationship, and I just suggested an idea of some kind of series. And he said, yes, in theory, it sounds good. Have a think a bit more about maybe how you would put it together. And just by him saying that, it made me think, okay, yes, I think maybe it needs to be a vocal series to sort of give it some identity. But it didn't have a name the first year. And we just did 5 nights and with 4 vocalists. The first one who kind of came to mind was somebody that I met in Brussels, a wonderful Belgian vocalist called David Lynx, who I'm sure you know, who's got a very long CV and is a very impressive songwriter as well. And he had been one of the judges at the Brussels competition. And I just thought he was an incredible talent and wanted to see him here. And then there was another vocalist, Italian singer, Maria Pia De Vito, who again hadn't played in London for a long time. And I really wanted to see her again. An American vocalist who I had seen at the Pizza Express about 15 years ago and again had never been back, Rebecca Paris, who is a, you know, if everything you would want, I should add her to the list actually, because everything you would want in the to learn about singing, the art of singing jazz, you can learn from listening to Rebecca Paris or seeing Rebecca Paris, because she's got that real old school tradition and was actually championed by Carmen McRae. So that kind of tells you everything. And then the fourth singer was the wonderful Norwegian vocalist Karen Krog. So that was my first year, and I think I got very lucky because they were all really wonderful people to work with, and you know, just so easygoing, and it was all very straightforward. But the thing that started at the very beginning of Revoice, I had the idea that I didn't want to just present the music like some sort of slightly anonymous promoter, I guess, that I wanted to do it in a musical sense, because I think maybe at that time, this is 5 years ago, fewer musicians were running these kind of events. Now it's great because in the UK, in London, there's a lot of musicians who are sort of putting on festivals or series. And I think that's really important because obviously promoters are hugely important and they do their job and we do ours. But I think when you get across, you know, fertilization of jobs, it's really healthy because we can learn from each other. So the idea was that I would do an opening set with a different musician each night, and then sort of present myself as an artist, and then present the main international artist with their band or with a UK rhythm section, depending. And so always to keep that that flavor, and that lasted, you know, up until the last edition, which was just in October. And you know, we've grown from 5 days in one venue to last year we did 12 days in four venues, two in London and two outside London. And you know, it's kind of kept the initial theme has been very much trying to give a platform to all this incredible international talent that didn't somehow make it always to London. And then obviously as it's gone on and got bigger, and it's not that it's got better, it's just got, you know, better known, and I guess it's been easier for me to then reach out to bigger name artists, if you like, and include them, or have them include me, I should say. So you know, this year we had Carmen Lundy headlining, and you know, which was an incredible experience for me to sit there and watch four shows and interact and meet her. And you know, we had Tuck and Patty and Raoul Midon a few years ago, and Gregory Porter was a really big part of the Revoice story, because I actually gave him his first booking in the UK just as he, you know, as he was sort of breaking, and then he came back the next year and was already, you know, quite a significant name. And you know, in this last sort of 4 years, obviously his star has risen and risen and risen. And, you know, it's really nice for me that he's been part of you know, of the story of the festival.
You know, it's great to hear about the festival and the fact that, as you mentioned, you know, kind of the artistic footprint in the festival management, if we can put it that way, so that you are an artist and you're also a festival director, and you know, kind of how the festival is thought, is planned, and it's kind of put in place. I think that really has an impact. And maybe, guys, you remember from episode 3 where we talked with Amy Bormet, who is a musician, and she's also the founder of the Washington Women in Jazz Festival. So there was also that connection in the sense where, like, from at least that's what I got from what you said, you know, the how a festival can be different when it's run by an artist. So like in case of Revoice, and you told us how he started out, so the first names you brought into the house. And you see, guys, how Georgia reached out to someone who participated at the, or that she connected with through the Brussels International Young Jazz Singers competition. And then the festival, as you said, has grown last edition. Over a week, you said 12 days, various venues, so four venues, two in London, two outside London. You mentioned a few of the headliners of the past edition. So you said last year's it was Carmen Landi, there's been Tuck and Putty, there's been Gregory Porter. So many, many, many big stars at the Revoice Jazz Festival. And I'm sure that also for you as an artist must be fun to kind of, you know, to be part of the festival, both as a performer, but also as a behind the scene, as a director and founder, is it?
That's the challenge, definitely, because, you know, I spend about 10 months of the year working on the festival, you know, obviously planning the events and doing all the various promo. And I really do everything myself. I'm very hands-on and, you know, whether it's through necessity or, you know, just a sort of wanting to learn, I think it's good. It's tiring, but it's good to think about all the elements. It makes it very, very personal experience. So, you know, whether it's writing the copy or selecting the photos of the artists and helping to do the design of the brochure and inputting the information on the website, and obviously dealing with the management of the artists and, you know, all the logistics of travel and blah, blah, blah. But then there comes a point when finally, you know, the festival starts and then, yeah, you have the moment for me where you're also now a performer and you have just half an hour to do a short set. And it's what brought me in mind to say about the experience at the Brussels singing competition is it's that, you know, you suddenly have had maybe 4 or 5 nights already of listening to the previous Revoice artists and being influenced and inspired by them. But then you have a moment where you have to stand up on stage and present yourself as an artist and just do the best that you can do that night, you know, and you know, have all the weight of these wonderful vocalists that you've heard, but also, you know, do your thing, because you can only do your thing, really. You know, realistically, you can only keep that alive, you know, full time. You can't be a carbon copy of anybody else, you know. You wouldn't be able to sustain that, I think, you know. So it's great. And also I suppose I made it as challenging as possible by playing with different people, if not every night, then almost every night. So, you know, for me, a big thing about Revoice, it's not just that it's a voice festival, it's a celebration of musicians, you know, and I feel that I owe everything I've learned to musicians I've played with, because, you know, I told you a bit about how I started, and I didn't go to music college. I, you know, I had lessons and classes, but I learned really sort of the old-fashioned way on the gigs with musicians, and I feel that's how I continue to learn. So it's been a really nice experience to sort of be able to put some of those musicians more in the spotlight, because so often if there is a front person, then it's not necessarily if it's a vocalist, but it can be an instrumentalist. I think sometimes the musicians, the sidemen, it's such a terrible name, you know, or the accompanist, you know, they immediately demotes them to this sort of inferior level, which it's not how I see it and see them, and not that how a lot of singers and musicians see them. So, you know, it's been really good to be able to say, I'd like to thank you and you and you and you, you know, and put your photograph in the brochure, because that all that sort of, you know, I'm very aware of how, you know, the headline acts are always the ones that have the name, you know, on the brochures or the flyers or the website. And then sometimes you see, you know, not even a listing of musicians' names. And I think maybe that's the difference between how a promoter might promote an event and how a musician might promote an event. You know, how we're just probably more likely to be attuned to our contemporaries and you know, want to make sure that they get their due, because, you know, as Dee Dee Bridgewater said, we're nothing without the musicians we play with, you know. Yeah. So it's important to sort of you know, celebrate that. And you know, because obviously I know what happens is people come to review gigs, and of course they do end up talking about the headliners, and you know, sometimes the band get a mention, but you know, so I try and do my bit to even that out, you know.
Yeah, that's, you know, that's, I think that you really nailed it. Like that, I think really, at least for me, that I've also worked in a music festival that wasn't organized by artists. It really made me understand like how you as artist slash director see the festival compared to a festival that is organized by a PR person, for example. You talked about, you know, kind of want to give credit also to the sidemen. It doesn't sound like, you said, it sounds a bit like like demoting, but I totally get it. And now, Georgia, I want to ask you to wear your festival director's hat, because I have a couple of questions that I'm sure that many of the listeners are asking themselves when thinking about organizing a festival. And the first question is, you know, how do you come up with dates and venues, in the sense that I'm not saying necessarily, you know, from October 9th to 12th, but more like, you know, why, for example, do you, as festival organizer, go for October and fall, for example, and not for January or the summer?
Yes, I started in, the first one we did was in end of September. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the run, you know, we had sort of very mixed audiences. You know, some nights were great, some were really quiet, and it was, you know, and I obviously was aware it was the first one and it takes time to build. But also from a practical level, the Ross Steins, the music manager, said this isn't as easy a time of year, so let's move it to October. You know, I think it there isn't a right or wrong time to do a festival necessarily, because it's going to depend on where you are. You know, if you're in Italy, in Tuscany, and it's sunshine and summer, you're going to say, why, you know, let's do it in the summertime. And, you know, and it would be a very different, you know, creation, I guess. If you're in a basement club in London and it's cozy and warm, it's you know, but it's not too cold that you don't want to leave the house, then, you know, October's a fantastic time of year, you know. But also I guess it's about what else is happening. And the only thing that I had worried about, which turned out to be very positive, was that the London Jazz Festival happens the month afterwards in November, and I thought it was going to be too close and it might be difficult to get people, but somehow it sort of ended up becoming almost like a nice preview for mm-hmm. London Jazz Festival, and obviously artists wouldn't do both, so, you know, it, in a way, it didn't complicate booking it. You know, if they were going to come to do the London Jazz Festival, then obviously they wouldn't been able to do Revoice, but that's okay. You know, we just find the way that, you know, from year to year, how it would work out best. But I think, yeah, and then we just stuck with October because it worked, and it was significantly better audience wise in the second year. Well, there was a lot to do with the branding. Suddenly, you know, had the name and the logo, and there was much more, you know. I think it takes the press a while to latch on to something, because, you know, so many things start and then fade away, so obviously they can't, you know, give attention to everything. But I think once people realize that, you know, hey, I'm still here and I'm gonna try again this year, and they see that, you know, there's progress. And then, say, in our third year, we did most of it again at the Beach Express, but we had a couple of nights at the Union Chapel, which is a bigger venue in a different part of London. And that's when we had Tuck and Patty and Raoul Midon. And, you know, I think I was trying each year to sort of make it keep very much its identity, but also surprise people, and, you know, not that they would get complacent that, oh, it's, you know, we know what to expect. So just try and push the boundaries a little bit. And even with the opening sets that I do, you know, just try and be a bit more creative, so that it's not 10 nights of piano and voice, or voice and guitar. And, you know, so sometimes it'd be voice and double bass. Or last year I did a duo with an amazing flautist that I work a lot with, Gareth Lockrane. You know, I've done one with vibes, Jim Hart, a fantastic vibes player, lots of double bass. So, you know, just to try and keep it interesting and challenging, and so that the audience, I wasn't maybe expecting that, you know. Mm-hmm. And so, and last year, really, the inclusion of the other venues, I guess you're saying about how to pick venues. I think that's quite new to me in terms of the festival, because it was the first time I'd had more than one venue. Well, sorry, more than two venues, and the first time outside London. And they were all venues that I had some kind of relationship with before. So there was already kind of a starting point. And that would definitely be something to explore, you know, further in further editions, because it kind of changed the flavor slightly. You know, I'm very comfortable being in the Pizza Express because they've supported us from the beginning and co-produced the event, you know, they're partners. So that's the sort of spiritual home, definitely, of the festival. But then taking it to the 606 Club in London, for instance, on our last night, it's a fantastic club in a different part of town in Chelsea, and they specialize in British based musicians rather than international musicians. So that was a chance to then showcase some British talent and work in a different way. So we didn't have, for instance, the opening set and the main set. There were three singers and three musicians, and we all played with each other, you know, duo, trio, as a band, and kind of just mixed it up and made that night specific to that venue. So I think that's sort of the way to maybe think about how to not to impose what you're doing on a venue that might not suit, you know, to try and to pick what's already good about that venue and what they've already built up with their reputation and their branding, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. So to kind of be open-minded and also to try to build a relationship beforehand. So like in your case, it was with the Pizza Express Jazz Club. You told us how you had performed there before, like many years before, and then how it became kind of the first venue of the festival, and then how it kind of, it's still one of the venues of the festival. And I want to ask you also about the lineups, because you had obviously many, many, many artists, like British artists, international artists. So when you know, when organizing a jazz festival, what are the things you, as in this case, director and also PR PR and booking, I should add, a woman, keep in mind when, you know, you're looking to put together a lineup for an edition of the festival? What are the things you think about and you should really, that the listeners should really pay attention to when planning their own jazz festivals?
Well, because Revoice is such a personal venture, I really just pick artists that I personally love, whether mm-hmm. it's someone I've known about for a long time or someone I've just come across, because, you know, as I said, I work on it for such a long time and I really get involved in every aspect. If I think I can't realistically sell someone, let's say, you know, and keep the enthusiasm because I don't really have the enthusiasm, after a month, I'm going to be struggling to think of positive things to say about that artist, you know. Whereas if it's a proper connection, you know, I think this person's music is, I love it. You know, I feel you have to have that sort of conviction to then try and sell that artist if they're not known, maybe to other people, and, you know, bring audiences in. And obviously everybody's taste is different, yeah, and okay. So you're not always gonna find people that everybody else agrees, you know, with your opinion. But I think if you don't have that sort of conviction yourself, I don't know, for me it doesn't have integrity, and I don't really see the point in doing it. But having said that, I think that the trick maybe with Revoice is to think, because it's specifically a voice festival, whereas if you were just putting on a festival and you would have some vocalists and some instrumentalists, you have more choice, obviously. But when it's just one instrument, say, I think the hard thing is not being in competition with yourself. So, you know, you don't have too many similar stylistically similar singers that, you know, maybe, oh, are they going to come on Monday night when they could come on Tuesday because it's a sort of, you know, it's too close. So you have to think as broadly, I guess, as possible within, you know, the context of what you like, but you have something that would appeal, you know, to somebody on one night and somebody else with a very different taste on the next night, so that, you know, you try and get full house every night if possible. And I think definitely over the over the years, I kind of, it helped me broaden my my palette, if you like, of artists that, you know, maybe become more open-minded about vocalists and, you know, and what I liked, and maybe something I liked last year I might not have really liked so much 2 or 3 years ago. So it's kind of been really interesting to sort of follow that development. And it's definitely more than just the voice for me. I think the performances that have stuck in my mind the most have been not just about those people having the best voices. It's been about the stagecraft and the presentation and, you know, the putting on of a show and the personal human interaction as well, because I'm dealing with, if not the artists themselves, which is my preferred way, then their manager or their agent. You know, if you connect with somebody, that makes so much difference that you know, then the next year you might try and invite them back again, or you just have a slightly different insight into their music, I think, if you can get to know them a bit personally.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know, Revoice for me is a very personal venture. Somebody else might approach putting on a festival in a different way, and it's no less valid. It's just different, I suppose. They might have more of a concept and, you know, think more about big names and big draws. That doesn't actually interest me. It's much more about, yes, Carmen Lundy is a huge name, but I think she's a phenomenal artist, and you know, and that's the thrill, is that she's, you know, she's coming to do Revoice. It's not that, you know, I think that's important, you know, to me, that they're artists that you personally connect to, and, you know, and then you have that to sort of start with to try and sell to your audience.
Yeah, I like that, you know, the concept. Also, when you talked about the importance of trying to diversify the lineup, in the sense that you don't want to kind of offer to, you know, kind of the same kind of evenings to the audience. I like that. And obviously, I agree with you that, you know, it depends from the goal of the festival. Like in your case, you wanted to make sure that you present artists that you like, that you are connected with, that you admire, and that, you know, that are interested in coming to London. In the case of Revoice, I love it. It's very interesting to really hear this behind the scene talk with you about Revoice. And the last question I have to ask you for this how to organize a jazz festival talk is about the promotion aspect of Revoice Festival. So obviously, you promote the festival throughout the year, particularly when it's festival season, but also off season. So my question is kind of twofold. So the first part of the question is, how do you promote the festival during festival season? And the second one is, like, is there something you do to keep the kind of the festival, you know, in the radar of its fans and the media during the rest of the year?
I think Twitter has been the biggest tool, in a way, for me personally, more than Facebook. Maybe I haven't quite got a handle on the Facebook page as opposed to the personal Facebook interaction. I find it a bit more labored, a bit more businesslike, and maybe it sounds bad, but maybe too much effort for the return. Whereas Twitter, I don't know, there's something much more generous about it. And throughout the year, I try, if not through the Revoice account, then, because I think everybody knows that Revoice is my baby. So, you know, I do quite a lot on Twitter throughout the year. So, you know, I genuinely want to support anybody else who's trying to, you know, get people down to their gig, and, you know, or if there's an event that's happening that I think is interesting. I think it's important to support your community, and then hope that they will support you back. And that's definitely, I think that happens, it grows, you know. So I think that's a big tool. There's a lot of thing. I don't think I've quite nailed the PR side of things, because, or the social media side of things, because of manpower, actually. Mm-hmm. Because I'm such a sort of one woman band.
Yeah, and until really involved.
Yeah, I think it's just how many hours in the day do you want to spend on? You have to decide, I guess. Or do I want to spend? You could really be prolific on, you know, social media, but at a cost to your health, probably. So because there's not really enough hours in the day, I probably could do a lot more. And it would be great to have sort of a financial situation where I had some interns working with me during the festival run this year who were amazing and so made such a big difference to me. But I think to actually get people involved a bit earlier on and help, you know, with the promotion side of things is a huge plus. And if anyone was thinking of starting an event, I think to have anyone else on board who, you know, just to bounce ideas, or, you know, to do jobs that take time but that someone else could do just as easily is kind of important, you know. And it took me a while to sort of realize that. I think the audience is a big thing. If you can, I'm trying to sort of get them to feel that Revoice is an experience, without that sounding really pretentious, but that they would maybe come back, because we have quite a long run. You know, for the last few years, it's been 9 to 12 days. So there's kind of time for, you know, someone who comes at the beginning to come back maybe, and to sort of offer an incentive, you know, discount or something. So we did a lot of, you know, mailing shots, e-shots, and discount offers if you sign up to the mailing list, and to try and build a sort of Revoice audience, if you like, which obviously helped having the Pizza Express, which is a very established venue, and they've got their own audience. So just to try and kind of hit in as many different places. Obviously the artist, if they're known, they may have an audience. The club may have an audience. You may have your own audience. The people you're playing with might have their own audience. And then the sort of the Revoice audience themselves, which is definitely something I've tried to build on. And then obviously press, as much press as you can get, as much radio, you know, as you can get, all of those things. You know, I think you just do everything and hope that someone comes from that, you know, avenue, some come from something else. And it's not that easy to tell where you're getting the audience from, I think, unless it's a very big name, and then, you know, it's easy, the work is kind of done for you. But the success, I guess, is getting a full house for an artist that isn't so well known. And I think the biggest marketing tool I've had is just is Revoice itself, in a way that it's kept going. And so after 5 years, our last edition was easier to fill those quiet nights than the first one or the second one. You know, I think that's the sort of measure of how well it's doing. And, you know, and I haven't sold every night out, but I guess that's the goal, that people take a risk. But I think, you know, realistically, this is often down to finances, you know, because if you had maybe a lot of sponsorship, you could afford to have free gigs, you know, just to get people to come to see, you know, artists they might not know, or daytime gigs, or, you know, or maybe workshops for children. There's all sorts of things that could be done to, you know, to grow your audience. I suppose you have to decide where you want to spend the time and where you are able to spend the time. But I think just keeping something going helps, having, oh yes, that's Revoice. I remember that from last year, you know, that just sort of helps people to galvanize maybe the experience they had last year, and hope it's word of mouth as well. You know, people talk to each other if they've had a good experience and try and, you know, get a new person in that didn't come last year. And I suppose the other question is of how, you know, to keep it alive, you know, during from one edition to another. I think, again, I don't do that much. I do some Twitter activity, you know, again, if there's an artist that's played, you know, Revoice before that's doing a show, it doesn't matter if it's in London or the UK, I would always try and retweet that and, you know, or mention the fact that they, you know, that they that they're doing a new album or something that that kind of keeps that family in its sense, I guess, alive. Or just other vocalists that you know you admire or vocalists that you'd love to see at the festival. I think that all helps. Anything kind of related to the music scene helps. But I think, I don't know, realistically, a year is quite a long time to keep that going without, you know, alienating. I mean, you could, again, put up, you know, photographs and videos and, you know, keep alive the years of the previous editions, which I guess as you have more editions, there's more of an archive to draw on. But I haven't worried too much about that because I think, you know, people need to move on to the next thing, and that's sort of normal, that's kind of what happens. And then, you know, you just wait till maybe 4 months before the next edition and kind of start to build it up again, you know, with the new artists, because, you know, you obviously are always looking forward to what's coming up.
Yeah, I think that like, if guys you are on Twitter, check out Revoice Festival. It's the official page of Revoice Festival. And I think that you actually are doing a great job because in, for example, now, like few months after the festival, you're still, like you're saying, you're still supporting friends of the festivals, past performers of the festival. So by promoting their upcoming gigs, their latest projects, whatever it might be that you tweet about, you stay, like you keep Revoice very active, and at the same time you support those artists. And by building that kind of connection on a promotional level, if we can call it like that, I'm pretty sure that what happens is that when it's Revoice Festival's time, those artists are gonna remember the help and the support they've gotten from you through the Revoice Festival Twitter page, and they're gonna do the same. And speaking of Twitter, guys, if you want to ask Georgia more questions, if you want to see what she's up to, you want to connect with her, make sure to type in Georgia Mancho and follow her on Twitter. I highly recommend it. I have been following her for some months. We are connected and I'm really happy. And Georgia, to wrap up this episode of the Jazzpot podcast, I have to ask you, we are now in February, so well over a month into the new year. Can you tell us a couple of things about your ongoing projects, or even if you have something coming up that you can share with us?
Yes, I'm having a very nice creative start to the year. And for the last couple of years, I've been playing with Alan Broadbent, who's the piano player I mentioned for the Irene Krull albums, but probably your listeners will know him. He's a two-time Grammy-winning pianist, very well known for his work with Charlie Hayden, Quartet West. And we have started a writing partnership in just the last 6 months. So working on that a lot, and hopefully we'll be doing some more gigs in the UK in the autumn. And then the other thing that I'm putting together is an album of some of the duos I've done at Revoice in the last 5 years. So that's kind of a long project. It's been long overdue, I should say, because each year I recorded them and thought, oh, this year I'll put the album out, this year I'll put the album out. But this, I'm going to try and do it this year because I'm actually going to have a sabbatical from the festival itself. So we're going to have a year break because we reached the fifth anniversary, so it seems like a good time. So there's going to be lots of writing. There's another project I'm working on with a wonderful British pianist called Tom Corley, and we had started writing some songs actually for our Revoice Festival appearance last year, and I'm hoping that's going to grow into a full album of original material. So lots of writing and lots of performing, and you know, as always, trying to just improve and connect with lots of great musicians here and, you know, overseas.
Sounds like it's going to be a very busy year, but I know that you love what you're doing, so I'm sure you're going to have a lot of fun. Okay, and as a last gift for the listeners, you have provided us with so much value. You shared your story, you gave out some incredible tips on how to organize a jazz festivals, and you told us, you know, your experience with Revoice Festival, both as the director and founder and as an artist who is involved with the festival. I have to ask you this. I've asked this before to Didi Bridgewater, Cyril Aimé, Nicholas Beard. Now I have you, another great jazz singer. So I have to ask you, can you sing us something for some 10, 15 seconds? Do you have something for us?
Well, I have the obvious goodbye song, I guess. the positive one, not the sad one. So pack up all my care and woe. Here I go, singing low, bye, bye, blackbird. Where somebody waits for me, sugar sweet, and so is he. Bye, bye, blackbird.
All right, sorry, I have to clap. Ladies and gentlemen, this was Georgia Mancho. Again, if you want to learn more about her, go to georgiamancho.com. If you want to learn more about Revoice Festival, her jazz, her vocal festival, go to revoicefestival.com. Make sure to connect with her on Twitter at Georgia Mancho. And while you're at it, don't forget to check out Revoice Festival's Twitter page at Revoice Festival. Georgia, I want to thank you so much for being here on the podcast, telling us more about your career and all the great things you do, both as an artist and festival director.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure, and thank you for all your hard work as well.
Oh, you're so welcome. Thank you. All right, everybody, we are back. Georgia, thank you, thank you, thank you so much, really, for being here with us, for sharing your story, the story of Revoice Festival, and for the tips you gave on how to organize a festival, how to promote a festival, and also when you talked about the music contests. Thanks for sharing your story with us. I really appreciate it. And guys, today is Thursday, so you know it's the last episode of the week, and I want to give you a quick sneak peek, like always, on next week's episodes. On Tuesday, we're gonna have one of those must-listen episodes, because on Tuesday we talk about how to protect your music. So we're gonna talk about the legal side of music and the business side of your career. So we're really gonna go and talk about the specifics on what you should really think about, and, you know, what you're risking if you don't take care of those things. Whereas on Thursday, we're gonna talk about visual content. We're gonna talk about strategies and tools you can use to create visual content to spice up your social media presence. So if you're using Twitter, or you're using Instagram or Twitter or Facebook, pretty much whatever social media you're using where you can share images, you're gonna hear more about how you can easily create visual content. So images, infographics, banners that people love, even if you don't consider yourself a creative person. Sounds like fun, right? Well, guys, you only have to wait a few days. Until next time, you can find all the episodes of the Jazz Spotlight podcast on iTunes at thejazzspotlight.com/show, or Stitcher if you're using Stitcher, thejazzspotlight.com/Stitcher, or SoundCloud. If you're a SoundCloud user, you can find the podcast there as well. Like always, all the links are in the show notes at thejazzspotlight.com/episode68. Yanni Lunga here. I want to wish you a great weekend, and I can't wait to be back with you on Tuesday. Take care.